And a shoot shall come out of the stock of Jesse, a branch shall bloom from its roots, and the Spirit of the Lord shall rest on him, a spirit of wisdom and insight, a spirit of counsel and valor, a spirit of knowledge and fear of the Lord.
You're listening to By the Well, a weekly podcast for preachers where we delve into one of the lectionary readings to help you preach the gospel in your communities. You can subscribe to our podcast anywhere you listen to podcasts, and you can get more information at our website, www.bythewell.com.au. I'm Fran Barber.
And I'm Robin Whittaker, and thank you for joining us today. We're very excited to have our first guest on this podcast, who is the Reverend Dr. Sean Winter, head of Pilgrim Theological College and a New Testament scholar, although we're going to mostly make him talk about the Old Testament today. And Sean is also a regular preacher in both Baptist and Uniting churches, both here in Australia and back in the UK where he's originally from. So welcome, Sean.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
I should say up the front, Sean is also Fran and my boss here at Pilgrim, so we will try and be extra nice to him today.
Indeed.
Our focus text, we're here in Advent 2, Year A, and we're really going to focus in on the Isaiah 11, 1 to 10 reading. And you just heard the first few verses of that read by Sean from Robert Alter's translation. We'll also talk a little bit about the Matthew 3 reading in terms of how Matthew picks up some of these themes and expectations. But Sean, take us into the context here. What is going on in Isaiah? What lies behind this prophetic proclamation that we've just heard a bit of?
Well, I think that Isaiah 11 picks up on the historical context that really shapes pretty much all of the oracles that we find in the opening chapters of Isaiah. It's the time at which the kingdom of Judah is under significant stress and in a certain degree of conflict. Scholars usually refer to this as the Syro-Ephraimite War. So yep. They're under threat from the northern kingdom and from Syria, just a bit farther on from there. And in particular, Isaiah is deeply critical of the current king, King Ahaz, probably at the time of this oracle. King Uzziah was the good king. Isaiah yep. starts prophesying when the King Uzziah dies. So the kings that come afterwards are the object of Isaiah's kind of prophetic critique in significant ways. So I think this text really is a text that begins with the idea that there is something fundamentally wrong with the way in which Israel's life, the life of the community, its relationships with its neighbours is being ordered. And so this generates the expectation or the hope that there will come a day when another kind of king will come along who will do things properly, put things right, establish some justice and things. So that's where the text begins. The verses that I read at the beginning are basically an announcement of a coming king from the Davidic line. So a shoot coming out of the stock of Jesse, a branch blooming from its roots in Alter's translation. And this is to talk about a Davidic king.
That's right, because we should remember that King David was the son of Jesse.
That's right, exactly. Yeah. Scholars have a bit of a debate about why David isn't mentioned specifically, and it may be that because Ahaz was claiming to be David's descendant, Isaiah is saying, well, we'll kind of jump back even further than that to make sure that, you know, the kingly line is really pure and kind of appropriate.
Yes.
So it's an announcement of kingship. And then what it starts to talk about is this coming king's relationship with Israel's God, and the spirit of Yahweh rests upon him. That gives him wisdom, insight. It then means that he's able to execute justice in an appropriate way. He does it by kind of seeing beyond the surface of things. He doesn't just see what people look like or what the outward circumstances are, but can really do proper work of judgment and establishing righteousness and peace in the land. And then the vision opens up into this wonderful vision of the peaceable kingdom, where it's not just about relationships between people, but relationships with animals, relationship between humanity and the non-human creation in this rather kind of idyllic golden age kind of description.
That's right. I think when I was rereading this in preparation, it occurred to me that people who are really into like eco-theology and ecology, this is a this is a passage they'll probably warm to because it does have the human, the animal world, and even the you know, forests and trees all inexplicably linked, inextricably linked, I should say, together.
No, that's exactly right. And it may be that at one stage these were kind of independent bits of prophecy, but they've been woven together here so that what the king, who is intimately related to Israel's God, who is the recipient of the divine bestowal of the Spirit, what that king brings is this work of establishing justice and restoring the created order to the way in which it ought to have been. So it's a kind of expansive vision, really, of the Davidic king who is to come.
Yeah, and I actually think there's some echoes here that are similar to what we heard last week in Isaiah 2, where there, Fran, you reminded us of the nations, which would have been perceived as the enemies of God, streaming towards the holy mountain. And here again we've got natural enemies like a wolf and a lamb, the leopard and the kid, somehow living in harmony. So again, this expansive vision of what peace and harmony can look like, even amongst those that might be seemingly natural enemies in our world.
I think there's an interesting question about what that language of, you know, wolf and lamb and other things signify. There are lots of Jewish texts, of course, in which animals are used as symbols of nations. So you could kind of read it literally that, you know, you'll go out and it will be like a kind of, you know, zoological scene in which, you know, animals are sitting down and aren't killing each other. But it might also have this symbolic notion that actually Israel and Israel's enemies will be able to live together. I say that because chapter 11 follows on from Isaiah chapter 10, very obviously, and Isaiah 10 talks about judgment on Judah's enemies.
Yes.
And on the northern kingdom. And interestingly, uses this kind of tree, this arboreal imagery. I'll just read you the verses from the end of chapter 10. Look, the master, Lord of armies, hacks away the treetops with an axe, and the lofty in stature are cut down, the tall ones brought low. These are trees that we're talking about. So that's the judgment on the northern kingdom.
Yes.
And then in the southern kingdom, there is this stump, and out of the stump, a shoot starts to grow and to create something new. Mm. So the text has this kind of rich mythological framing, but it's also a deeply political text, I think, in the context of Isaiah's
name. Yeah, incredibly political. And I think it's such a beautiful and striking image, this shoot out of the stump of Jesse. I think any Australian who's, you know, where bushfires are fairly frequent occurrences can imagine we've got images of, you know, burnt out, you know, completely kind of denuded forests, and yet you see the spark of new life in some kind of shoot. And that's the image here of new life in the midst of total destruction and desolation, really.
This is the message of Isaiah, that when as a book as a whole, that at the very point where everything looks like the story is over, things are dead, God has finished with us, that's the point at which then God speaks and creates something new. Behold, I am doing a new thing. Of course, it comes to very rich expression in the later chapters of Isaiah.
Yep. Can we tease out this word shoot? There's a bit of a word play here with, you know, it could be rod, it could be, you know, do you think an ancient hearer might have got that word play and thought, we know it's a shoot, it's a tree image at one level, but it's also clearly an image for a ruler, as you've been outlining for
us. Yeah, absolutely. So the term gives the sense to the reader, there are a number of terms through here that do that, both of the way in which the imagery serves the overall political agenda that is being promoted here, that actually the king who is in place isn't doing the job properly and we need a new king.
Yeah, that's right.
I read passages like this and they are works of amazing imagination built into tradition, as you've talked about. I'm wondering how they speak into communities now, into the 21st century. That's something here that seems impossible back in Isaiah's time. How do we preach it as possible now?
Yeah.
I mean, my sense of this is that even to ask that question is somehow to kind of land on the point. Isaiah, as a canonical text, does this often. It kind of moves between deeply judgmental, critical accounts of the reality of kind of what's happening in the life of Judah, in the life of the people of God, and what they've done wrong, where they've taken the wrong path. And it intersperses these with these kinds of idyllic, utopian visions of what might eventually come and be possible. And I think that the wager that Isaiah as a prophet was undoubtedly making in the 8th century, which is when this text is from, is that actually if you cast that vision, then it does have direct consequences in the here and now. Like you have to have a wager that if you give people an understanding of how things might be different, then that will actually make a difference.
So you're saying that a preacher needs to cast you know, a big vision of what is possible with God when we enter this theological worldview, that and then because that in itself is helping reshape the present.
So I think if I were preaching in this text, I mean, I'm very conscious of the homiletician Tom Long's thing, that when you read a biblical text, what you're trying to do as a preacher is to do and say in your setting what the text did and said in its own setting. So what this text is doing is not giving a prescription for what the new political arrangements look like.
No.
It's not giving you kind of nuts and bolts of what you need to change or how you should adapt your lifestyle or how you should arrange your community differently. What it's doing is saying the only way you're going to see what the possibility is if you get a sense actually of what it is that God has always intended for humanity in relationship with each other, in relationship to creation more broadly. And that expansive vision, I think, is part of the work of the preacher. And you don't do it by reducing the content down to some kind of moralistic advice or some kind of practical suggestions. You do it by capturing people's imagination and taking them into the breadth and the expansiveness of it. That's what poetry does. This is poetry.
Isaiah also does this because he's incredibly honest and real about the devastation and the destruction. There is a real tackling of grief and loss that seems impossible to overcome.
Yeah.
One doesn't want to stand in the pulpit and, you know, depress the people unduly.
No.
But I think it has to be said that there are aspects of our current time also which do seem despairing and we don't seem to have leaders who wear the belts of righteousness, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I think also in the preaching with that expansive vision presupposes that there is this big gap between God's promise and where we are.
So I think this is where, you know, the lectionary becomes unhelpful because it chops things up where they're held together. So there is a sense in which the message of Isaiah 11 has its full kind of effect for those who have read chapter 10.
Yeah, that's
and if,
right.
If you've read chapter 10, which says that if you get this too wrong, then what is it? The master lord of armies hacks away at the treetops with an axe.
Yeah.
And this is the idea that actually connects with the Matthew 3 reading from the lectionary. The axe will be laid at the root of the tree. This is what John the Baptist says is part of his interpretation of the current political circumstances in the first century of the common era. So it's only when you grasp how deep that goes that there's now going to be a shoot that emerges, actually becomes a genuine message of hope. You can't understand what hope is until you've actually grasped the full extent of the despair, I don't think.
And I think we'll touch on that in a few weeks, week or two's time, with the impossibility of the birth, where there was no life and things were humanly impossible. God brought forth life.
My understanding is that these Sundays in Advent are largely about setting exactly that kind of framework. Advent is a time of waiting, but it's not kind of waiting absentmindedly, wondering what's going to happen. It's an intentional waiting in which you are invited to look within to see actually what is the truth about our lives in this world and the world in which we live. But then also to begin to look up, to imagine the possibility that it might be different. And this text undoubtedly lies at that, well, this is how it might be different, end of the spectrum. And of course, what you get is you get the New Testament picking up some of the themes here and starting to bring some of the wording of this text very clearly relate to aspects of the life and ministry of Jesus, someone who is endowed by the Spirit, bestowed upon him by the God of Israel, someone who at the end of his temptations in Mark's gospel is accompanied by wild beasts in yes. some kind of idealized, utopian, non-conflictual situation, someone who stands up for righteousness, adjudicates on behalf of and works for the people of the land, the poor. There are all sorts of ways in which New Testament expectations about what who Jesus is and what Jesus does picks up on some of the motifs that we find here in Isaiah 11.
Do you think preachers need to be cautious in reading a text like here in Isaiah explicitly Christologically or with a view to Christ? Have you got yeah. any
as if this was only
say,
talking about Jesus?
Which, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yes, I do have cautions. the main caution is that while this is a text that clearly points, if you read this text too straightforwardly in the light of Christ, what you do is you profoundly reduce the capacity for anticipation, hope, surprise, and the unexpected nature of what it is that the New Testament actually describes.
Can you unpack that a bit for yeah. us? Are you saying that kind of almost flattens Isaiah because you're saying, well, this has all been done and fulfilled and
exactly.
there's no other vision?
And everyone kind of saw Jesus and thought, oh, he's the Isaiah 11 guy. That's not what happened.
No. A lot of people didn't quite make that connection.
Well, most people didn't, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
And it was only really in the light of the resurrection that people started going back to these texts and making these kinds of connections, I think.
Yeah.
At one level, this is a text. I mean, if we take Matthew 3 seriously, the other text for today, this is a text and a set of imagery that probably informs the ministry of John the Baptist more than it does Jesus.
Well, yes. There's a mention
in the first instance.
Yeah.
There's clothing. The belt of righteousness, the belt of righteous judgment. That's
yes.
very John the Baptist in Matthew 3. The tree imagery, an axe shall be laid at the root of the tree, also I think is there. And I think the point generally is...
He also mentions vipers in Matthew, and there is a snake in here, but that's
yes.
You brood of vipers.
You brood of vipers.
There you go.
Yes, he's not a subtle or a meek our John the Baptist.
No, that's right. So the power of this text, I think, is gained initially by understanding it in its historical context in relationship to the political historical life of Israel.
Yep.
And what the role of a prophet like Isaiah was in that context. Once you've done that, what you do is you see themes emerging that you can begin to see the claims about Christmas start to address in significant ways.
What does
this king look like? How will this king come to us? What does justice, right judgment, wisdom, insight, strength, what do all of these things look like? And the Gospels have a particular account of the way in which the life and ministry of Jesus fulfills those expectations or meets them in certain ways, but probably in ways that at the time most people didn't recognize, of course.
Yeah, that's right. And there's, I mean, one of the things I love when I reflect about preaching is we are participating in a really, you know, we who preach today, are participating in a really long tradition now. We've got Isaiah's effective preaching, prophetic preaching. We've got Matthew's picking up of some of those themes in various ways to make sense of the person and life and death and resurrection of Jesus, which is its own form of proclamation. And then the challenge for us 2,000 years on, I mean, there's about an 800-year gap, you know, depending how you measure it, between Isaiah and Matthew. We 2,000 years on are called to do the same task, which is pick up the breadth and depth of these theological themes for our time and context.
It's particularly hard in our time and context, though, because although there might be 800 years between that and the Gospels,
yep.
the questions and the answers to one another were more free-flowing. My question is the culture asking the question for which this is an answer?
I think to the extent that we live in a world and in cultures where there continue to be questions about the viability of the settled political accommodations that we've come to about how we govern our lives, how we mm-hmm. relate to one another, what we're doing in relationship to creation and the environment. To the extent that those are live questions to us, I think there are all sorts of places in our contemporary world where some people are saying, well, what we've settled on might not be the best way.
Yes.
And yep. use your imagination, and you might actually be able to think that there is another way of doing it. What's striking about this text is that kind of utopian imagination, which has, as I've argued, a strongly political, poetic dimension to mm-hmm. it, is very strongly connected in Isaiah 11 to a particular claim about God's relationship to a person, in this case, the king. So the king will come and bring justice. The king will come and restore creation. The king will come and bring the nations back to Mount Zion. But why is it the king that does that?
And not God.
And not God. Because the king is the one upon whom the spirit of the Lord rests.
Yes.
And that spirit brings counsel and valor and enables the fear yep. of the Lord. So the kind of Christian version of this, the version that I would want to hear from pulpits, is not just the imagination of how we can live differently or how we can do politics differently or how we can do environment differently, but one that consistently connects that with the idea that God has actually endowed, in the Christmas story, has endowed Jesus of Nazareth with the Spirit in such a way that when we look at his life and when we see the way in which he embodies these values and these kind of, we actually get a sense of what that might be and how we might follow it.
Yeah, so, I mean, and remembering, of course, that this messianic expectation, Messiah, is literally the anointed one.
Absolutely.
So the one on whom God's Spirit rests, and we get that in the baptism stories. We get that throughout the gospel, that, affirmation that Jesus is that one. And I think that then does put flesh on it, literally, giving us a more sort of specific model. Although, of course, we still have to do some work and interpretation between Jesus' time and ours as to what that looks like. But if I'm hearing you correctly, Sean, it's a reminder that any kind of thinking about the way communities and are structured around justice and righteousness and these big themes we've talked about, peace and hope, for Christians need to be deeply centered on Christ. This isn't about just being a good person or a good citizen, that actually it's quite particular.
And the way of thinking about it, it's not just in Christianity, of course. I mean, it's here yeah. already in Isaiah within the Jewish tradition. The question, what does the world need to be, is deeply connected to the question, where does God show up and how do we encounter and meet with God? Those two things are part and parcel of the same question. It's interesting the way in which towards the end of the passage in verse 10, we actually kind of return to the root of Jesse imagery.
Yes.
So on that day, the root of Jesse that's standing shall become a banner for nations. Nations shall seek him out and his resting place shall be glory. The language that's used there of seeking out and resting place is actually language associated with the temple elsewhere in other Old Testament texts. I think in Isaiah 2, the nations come up to the temple to seek.
Yes.
To seek God. I think it's the same.
Zion. Yep.
I think it's the same verb that's used. So the idea is not just that there's this vision of how, you know, the world might be different or nations might actually recognize how they're supposed to live and what justice is. It's they will actually also come to see where Israel's God is present in the world and be drawn into that. And I think that's what prepares the way for the claims that are then made about the life of Jesus Christologically in the New Testament, that it's in this life that we see this in some kind of definitive way. And therefore, if you're going to proclaim a Christian version of utopia, it needs to be fundamentally connected to an account of the significance of this life and the relationship between Israel's Messiah and Israel's God.
And you've just reminded us, of course, that it is always about that pointing to God, just as John the Baptist did, that, you know, if that's what the nations are drawn to, it's not about pointing to ourselves, it's not about pointing to our, you know, whatever our unique expression of faith is in whatever place, it's actually always about pointing beyond.
Absolutely, and John the Baptist's ministry is fundamentally described, even at those points where he's kind of pointing fingers at Israel's leaders in judgment, he's also then pointing them to the coming one who will baptize with the Holy Spirit.
Yes. And that's the tension we have to balance at Advent, is we are pointing to the coming one that we celebrate specifically in the baby Jesus, but of course we're always trying to cast that larger vision, which is partly why Fran and I decided to focus on Advent, on Isaiah a little bit in these first few weeks, because I think it does cast these larger visions through all these beautiful metaphors.
Yeah, and particularly at the start of Advent, you get to see the promise of the end. Like the beginning of the Christian year, you see a vision of the end.
Of what this is all headed towards. Yeah.
That's right. Well, we're going to need to leave it there.
Thank you very much for visiting us at our podcast, Sean.
Yes. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been wonderful having your input. And thank you to our listeners. This podcast has been made with the support of Pilgrim Theological College in Melbourne, the Uniting Church in Australia, and through our wonderful technical assistant, Adrian Jackson. You can subscribe to this podcast at iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you find your podcasts. Please share it with your friends and rate us so that other people can find this too.